All right, welcome to the Return to Service podcast. I'm your host, Chris. I'm joined today by Bill Gianetti, founder and president of FlightStar. Thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
So, all right, FlightStar, you're going to be at MBAA at West Hall booth 3041. EBIS Software will be at West Hall booth 2621 with Tron Air. I know you won't be there because you're doing a trip over to the Middle East, but I did want to have you guys on. I wanted to understand a little bit more about the history of the company, how it got started, really how it grew into something where you guys have maintenance, charter, avionics, interiors, and FBO. And then also kind of the future of what you guys are doing and why you're building out this hangar. So yeah, wherever you want to kick it off.
Sure. I mean, I guess you could call us the 47-year overnight success story. So we started here at Willard Airport. There was no FBO, and I was working at a small airport on the other side of town as a flight instructor and charter pilot. And one of my students and a guy that I became good friends with, we thought we'd like to start our own aviation business. And there was an opportunity here at this airport since it was there was no FBO. It was run by the University of Illinois. And we basically talked him into letting us go for like 6 months and see what happens. And we had an office trailer with wheels on it parked next to a hangar. And that started our little flight school. We were able to talk a local bank into giving us a small business administration loan. And in fact, that banker called me not too long ago when I got the Wright Brothers Award thing. He called me and he said, "Hey, I'm really proud of you guys." He's like 80 years old now. And I said, "You're responsible for this. If it wasn't for you, I would have been a retired airline pilot by now." So anyway, the bank lent us money. We bought some airplanes. We started teaching flying. We started doing charter flights. And it just grew in little tiny steps the whole way. We hired a mechanic to do oil changes and take care of some of our airplanes because we couldn't get them into shops. And just one thing led to another. And we go from 3 employees to like 170 employees. And from gross sales of around $200,000 the first year to $43 million this year. So been a big change and all organic growth. No outside money, no outside investors. Everything we've done was by plowing money back into the business and you know, we had a desire to grow. We had a desire to do more and to get into more things. And so that's how it started. And we got lucky with a few things. We had some really wonderful aircraft owners in town that bought airplanes and bought jets and had us manage those airplanes. We were lucky enough to get tied up with American Eagle Airlines before they were fully owned by AMR. And doing some maintenance on their aircraft. And that started some 25 years ago or so. And we still do maintenance on Envoy, American Airlines regional airplane that serves Champagne. So that's been a big part of our business is airline maintenance. And then we started with the MRO side with light plane maintenance, got into turboprop maintenance, started working on Falcons since we operated Falcons, and then got into the Bombardier products in the early 2000s and ended up becoming an authorized service facility for Learjet through Bombardier. And that kind of gave us the bona fide service center aspect that we were looking for and brought us more and more Learjet 4070 aircraft. So we have touched more than half the fleet to this date, so it's pretty cool. We're a very, I guess, credible Learjet shop, and a lot of guys seek us out. We're a small company. It's a small town, Midwest work ethic. We know everybody's name. We have very low. We don't have a lot of layers of management, and therefore we can provide a more personalized experience for the customers that come in for work. And then, of course, we do charter flying, we do the line service, all that kind of thing. So,
do you feel like as the business grew and these opportunities came up, was it looking at ways that you could add new lines of business to service the existing business and kind of make things better for both your existing customers and the, you know, I guess the existing company and the employees itself? Or what was kind of like what's the lens as you evaluate new opportunities? How do you look at that?
Well, our basic philosophy was if we saw something that looked like a business opportunity, we attempted to go after it. And if people said, hey, can you help us work on these American Airlines planes at night out on the ramp and change light bulbs? We're like, sure, we can do it. We said yes to anything. No was not in our vocabulary, and it still isn't. We even tell our front counter staff, look, if a guy wants a crew car, you just say yes. You don't ask him for this, that, the other thing, where he's going, just give him the car. And it's, again, we're say yes to the client, and we figure out a way to get it done. And so that's how we've grown. I mean, we've just basically, if somebody held out the smallest opportunity for growing the business, we latched onto it and tried to do our best with it.
Where does that philosophy come from? Have you had that always? Did that come from like a family background or something? Like, where does that mindset come from?
I think it was just my partner that I started the company with and myself. We just wanted to keep going. We didn't want to stop. We didn't want to have a boat or retire or have a big house or spend time in, you know, our vacation house. You know, flying is my hobby. So when I get to go fly a trip, that's my fun days at work. And then I come back and do this stuff here in the office to run the company. But, you know, it's like, this is what I love to do. So having an office at the airport and being able to come out here every day to be involved with the people in aviation and other pilots and aircraft owners and people that love airplanes. It's just been what we like to do. So it's been sort of a natural, you know, I wish we could grow faster, actually. but, you know, since we've done it essentially on our own without outside investors, it's been kind of neat. So we're a privately held company, and we have nobody that we answer to. But that tends to maybe slow you down a little bit because we don't have somebody giving us $10 million or $25 million to build a, you know, a giant paint facility, for example.
Sure. But do you feel like that kind of natural restriction of not having outside investors, has that played a role in refining the processes and getting things dialed in? Because, you know, and like, if you don't have that investment money, there's not much room for, you know, you know, not much room for fat, and there's not much room for like nonsense. It's kind of all gotta land, and you gotta be on, and you gotta be moving. Do you feel like it's actually been a positive in that sense, or how do you perceive it?
You know, it makes you focus, and it's kind of like, I feel like I'm a captain and I'm chained to the bridge of the ship.
Okay.
So I'm going down with it if it goes, and so it does focus you that way. Some people with outside investor money, they bring in a CEO or a president, and he's got a special deal that if everything goes to heck, he gets, you know, $5 million and gets to walk away. It's not like that with us. We're always risking almost, you know, we risk a lot every day. Even building this new hangar, $7, $8 million hangar, it's like, boy, it's going to be, we've got to get the work cranked up to make the payments on this, because it's, you have to borrow money to do these things, and then you better have the cash flow to make those payments. So it seems like we never get past the risk nature of it. And it also focuses us to, you know, we cannot fail.
Yeah.
So it's that simple.
Okay. It's interesting. And so taking this new hangar, right? When you look at a decision like this, it comes with this much risk, this much dollar amount, all the factors that go into it. First off, why are you guys building it? What's kind of the plan to it? And how did you evaluate that this was the right move?
So we have our shop has grown from smaller hangars to larger hangars and now to even a larger hangar. And I don't mean we've moved. We've actually filled up the small one, filled up the medium one. Now we're going to fill up the larger one. So we know we have the work. We just need the space. So the goal behind this was we are overflowing at the seams. We, even with just the Learjet maintenance, we're already seeing aircraft being pushed into our other hangar spaces to wait for work or to even be worked on. And we felt like, okay, we have the demand. It's time to expand the shop. And what we did by building, what we were building is a large, mainly storage hangar that will take our largest airplanes that we store in a big hangar now and move them to the end of our facility, down to the far end of our complex, and open up that hangar, which is right next to the current large maintenance hangar, for maintenance. So what it does is it now creates a complex of four hangars all in a row, all hooked together, that are dedicated to maintenance. One is dedicated to airline maintenance, the other three to GA jet MRO type maintenance.
Okay. And what's kind of the strategic advantage of having them connected, if you will?
Well, so, I mean, first of all, visual. I mean, you see everything. It's like having it under one roof. All the logistics with parts and moving toolboxes and even, you know, things like compressed air and ground power units and those kind of things puts that all under one roof. If we had it to do over again, we'd build just a big four bay hangar, you know, and everything all hooked together just perfectly. But this has been a sort of a piecemeal growth. So it's a little more, I guess, cobbled looking, but it does, you know, it will work. And, so yeah, that was the whole design to create this one maintenance facility. And we actually, all the other two hangars are hooked on to the end of this complex. So okay, if we decide to move more maintenance, we can just keep going down the road and pushing the stored airplanes out and moving those hangars to doing just maintenance. So the complex is actually pretty cool. I mean, it's almost, you can walk from one end of our company to the other inside and out of the weather and through hallways and doors that we've installed. So if we could get rid of the airport firehouse, which is in the plan for the future, we will build a hangar next to our building where the firehouse sits. And then I'll be able to walk from my office to the far end of our complex without going outside, which would be pretty cool.
That will be pretty cool. And, I want to come back to kind of the vision of this and how some of this came to be, but I do want to ask you about the state of a lot of MROs right now. I've done a few podcasts over the past week or so talking with other MROs and then also brokers and, you know, aircraft managers. And there is a lot of frustration around the lead times and things like that, or, you know, overselling jobs or, you know what I'm talking about, every aspect of that. And I got to imagine that the growth will bring a need for more technicians and things like that, or maybe it doesn't. So just curious, as you look at the growth and how to support this, what are some of the steps you guys are taking to make sure that you can support the growth and it delivers what you're hoping it does?
Well, obviously, technicians are the hardest thing to deal with right now. There's definitely a shortage of experience, someone with at least 5 years of turning wrenches already. There's a lot of, you know, new certificate holders with the ink not yet dry. And we like those guys. We bring them into the airline division because that work in the airline side is more boilerplate. It's more removing inspection covers and things like that. It's not troubleshooting so much or having the knowledge of systems. So the younger guys, we can start in the airline division, but finding skilled, 5, 10, 15 year experience technicians is very difficult. All the shops are doing the same thing. You see a Westar or a Standard Aero or something. Hey, we're expanding. We're going to hire 200 technicians. I'm like, yeah, sure you are. Where are these guys coming from? It's become a game of poaching. It's become a scientific game of poaching in that there are recruiters that hang out in bars near big shops and catch the guys after work and try to convince them to come to work for them, that they have a better deal.
Seducing and technicians.
So it's taking poaching to a new, a new level of expertise.
Wow.
So finding technicians is a huge problem, and we're working on that. We have a full-time recruiter. That's all he does. We are committed to providing a great place to work, a top dollar wage. We're not going to be the cheapest shop out there. We're gonna be right up there in terms of hourly rate with anybody, Duncan or Westar or Standard Aero, any of those guys, because we have to be able to charge enough to pay top dollar. And the guys that do that will survive. The guys that try to be discount guys and hire cheap guys, not going to work out, because they're going to be poached and find other opportunities. But aside from wage, it's benefits, it's quality of life, it's the work environment, it's the facility. If you see our maintenance break room and locker room area, it is absolutely high end. It is super nice. It is clean. It is top fixtures. Nothing skimped on. We wanted to make it a place where technicians would come in and go, wow, this looks like a place I'd like to work. But every time you grow, it comes with new challenges. You build a locker room that has X lockers in it. Next thing you know, you need 20 more guys and you're out of space. Mm-hmm. And it's this constant battle of trying to keep pace with the growth. And with growth comes more headaches and more problems and more mistakes. And, if you're operating a business that has two customers a day, it's pretty easy to keep your shop clean. If you've got 100 customers a day, it's a whole new ballgame. So part of that growth is it comes with a lot of challenges, and you need more support staff. You need more inspectors. So we're aware of that, and we're working to stay ahead of it. But it's always an incremental thing. It's kind of like you build an apartment complex. You'd like it to be full the day it opens. And now you need to build another apartment complex because you're already full. So it's kind of the way our shop is. We're going to expand the shop. Now we're full. Now we have to think about the next tank. So anyway,
yep,
it's a good problem to have, that we have good repeat clients, and we have a loyal clientele. One of the issues that you've probably heard about, or you would understand, is the Learjet product line is a legacy product line now. It is no longer in production. So obviously these airplanes will be in service for many more years, but we've got to expand out of just the Learjet line, which has been our bread and butter for the last 5 years or so. So we're looking at the Challengers and other airframes to expand that work scope, so we have, our eggs are not all in one basket.
Yeah, and it's probably like a lesson that you learn over time of running the business and seeing how it grows and seeing how things change, because obviously things today are not the same as when you started it in 78. So it's like, it's like the role probably evolves, I'd imagine, as you go through from being, boots on the ground to having to look out. What does the next 5 years, what does the next 10 years look like? If we stayed on the exact same course as we're on today, does that actually put us out of business in 10 years, at this pace?
Well, and that's a good point, because when I went to the university and learned about business, it was, hey, what's your 5-year plan, your 10-year plan, always a plan looking ahead to some moment in time, 1 year, 5 year, 10 year. We've learned that it's hard to have a 1 month plan.
Yeah.
The world changes so quickly that you have to be agile. You have to adapt to change. A lot of people don't like change. People don't like change. You don't like things different than they used to be. And so our goal is to watch as carefully as we can to make sure that we're steering in the correct direction to follow where the market is going. And it's not super critical because there's a lot of airplanes out there that need maintenance, but and there's less and less good shops. The smaller shops just are having difficulty. The one and two man places, or even the five man places, just very hard for them to compete because the bigger places offer higher pay, better benefits, more amenities for the employees. So we want to be, our one goal is we want to be the guys that survive. And, we have to charge, we have to pay, we have to provide a great place to work. And my goal is to try to give the guys that work on the floor what they need to do their job as best as they can and rely on their expertise so they can tell me what they need and, what I can provide for them. Because I'm not out there on the floor every day. I don't know what, I don't want to, in other words, I don't want to give them XYZ and they say, well, we didn't need that. We need this. Mm-hmm. So I have to rely on the expertise in the shop side, in the MRO side, in every aspect of the business to tell me, what do you need? What's the best way to invest our money? If we're going to spend money on improving things, where is that best invested?
And did you always have that that perspective of like, let me trust the guys doing this job on the floor? Or is that something that you had to learn over time and kind of gradually learn that lesson or learn it the hard way? Or is it something that from the jump you were like, all right, let the experts do what they need?
The problem with starting a business from, when you're 23 years old and
you know everything.
Yeah, well, I thought I did. And what you learn is you don't know anything.
Mm-hmm.
But the biggest deal is when it's a small business, you're making all the decisions. Really, it's just you and a handful of people that it's affecting. But you get to the point where you cannot digest everything that's going on. You don't want to be the micromanager that continues to hang on to every little detail and basically bog things down. My goal would be to hire people in their field that are smart, much smarter than me and are experts in their field to tell me how do we do our job? What's the best way to invest our money? What's the best way to grow that side of the business? So I look for people that know their job much better than I do to tell me which way do we go here? How do we spend our money the best? How do we invest it the best? How do we keep growing the business? And I keep saying growing the business because, I mean, that is the name of the game. You look at places like a Dunkin', for example, just opening up an engine. They just announced they're building an engine overhaul facility. I'm like, wow, can we ever catch those guys? I mean, they never stop. I mean, and that's the name of the game. You've got to just be going and going and don't slow down.
And so I guess from maybe it's a philosophical level, right? You mentioned growth comes with more headaches, more challenges, more unknowns, more everything that could be viewed as a negative, but it comes with the territory. So what's the question I'm looking for? For lack of a better word, why? Why keep growing? Like what's your mindset in terms of like, all right, we're moving ahead. This is why we're doing it. We're going to grow. We're going to be the best. I'm going to continue to provide top quality for my employees. I want to have a strong customer base. We're going to continue looking for other lines to support. Like, why, for lack of a better question? Not, yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it's just the way that I am and the way my partner and I were in the beginning. We were, the growth meant survival to us, mm-hmm. and it still means that. So I'm not one to retire or sit back and relax and count money or whatever super successful people do. I feel like we're always in the fight. We're always in the struggle, and we have to just keep on pushing forward. So, I mean, that's essentially the mindset. And, you know, as a manager and someone that runs a business or someone that manages a department, you know, all you do is solve problems every day. That's what it's all about. So when we create more problems, okay, that's job security for management, because that's what your job is to do. Mm-hmm. There's no job where you go and just everything runs fine. You sit at your desk and shuffle papers. You're constantly being beat up by something. It's always something you didn't expect. It's something you've never seen. You'd think after almost 50 years in business, we'd seen it all, but you haven't. You're surprised every day. And, you know, and then you throw in the aspect of the human factor where, you know, people make mistakes and you're like, how did we make that same mistake again? You know, it's just the way it is. You have to keep working on that every day. It's a constant battle.
Do you feel like
the FAA guys would say, you know, there's pilots that run out of fuel every year. You're like, when are these guys going to stop making this mistake? And that's our job as managers, is to continually try to see that we don't do those kinds of things.
And do you feel like continuing to be in the fight and have these challenges and solve these problems, like, does it like help bring out an aspect of yourself or your personality, or, you know, like a sense of fulfillment with that? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I feel like it's less that, it's more we survived another day.
Okay.
It's like, I feel like we're always in the survival mode. It's just the reason we grow, the reason we work hard, the reason we, invest money in the business is because we want to survive. We want to be, we'd like to be a leader in our field. We'd like to be the in the same class as the well-known names in the industry. And, it's hard to do it from a zero to now aspect. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of guys that walk in and they have investors and they build some giant thing right off the bat and seem to like start from where we are now, but that they're few and far between and they don't always succeed. We've made a lot of mistakes. We've learned a lot over the years. So I feel like we're not going to make a stupid mistake that, hurts us. We just continue to try to grow and do it in a controlled fashion, but we want to move forward.
Yeah. I mean, but it's also that, that piece of looking out and seeing people get a bunch of money and then kind of build something big from the jump and all these kind of things. You know, I even see it when I go on LinkedIn or I look at salespeople and all this kind of stuff. They'll be at bigger companies and they have all the answers. And I've been at, you know, family companies where, you know, people come in from some of these mega companies and they've got nice acronyms and a good PowerPoint and all that stuff. And it doesn't mean that they're bad, but there is a dynamic nature of having run something from the ground up, from building it yourself, from having crashed into the walls yourself and, experiencing that pain, not twice removed, but directly, that really does add a level of character, a level of tenacity, problem solving that if you're not in the fight, if it doesn't really matter to you, you don't have the same deep well to draw from. And I get that sometimes too, where I'll look out at some people doing something. I sold this $1 million deal, or I did this thing, and you get this, not envy, but like a light envy or something. But then you kind of have to sit back and go, oh, I did X, Y, and Z. I got kicked in the teeth X, Y, and Z times, but Like, I know that no matter what situation I get put in at this point, I'm going to figure out a path forward. Whatever it is, like, I can solve it and go. So I don't know. There's like a deepness to having like lived that type of experience. Does that make sense?
No, I totally agree. It's helped me personally to understand people, to understand my role as a leader in the company and what I need to do to motivate people and to show them that they're cared for and that I respect them and, you know, very conscious of decisions on how they affect people. We don't fire many people. We're very good at keeping people engaged and working through issues with them and making them better employees and better team members. So part of that whole, you know, starting from scratch experience really helps you become a empathetic leader and you know, have the depth of experience and I guess life experiences to go through trying times with people, or, you know, the pandemic or whatever. The pandemic required a sort of a steady hand as we navigated this complete unknown. And I think we did it very well, just because we were, you know, first we're committed and we didn't panic. So, but yeah, you're right. It's very easy for somebody to come out of, you know, the Wharton School or, you know, some MBA program, and he's going to come in and show everybody how it's done with his accounting skills and things like that. And some of those guys are really good, and some guys do very well, but they don't have the commitment. They don't feel, you know, they, if it doesn't work out for them, they throw their resume out and move on. With us, I've always felt that I have no place to go. If this thing falls apart, I'm going down with it. So, and I think most of our staff feel that way. You know, they all want it to succeed. They all feel deeply attached. So, you know, and it's being proud of your operation, having a great facility. You know, we demand that it's kept super clean, organized. We want people, when they walk in here, to say, wow, that's a nice place. So, you know, image is very important to us, and, you know, not in a superficial way, but, you know, when the guy had, we have clean bathrooms, and, you know, I'll go into the bathroom, I'll see water in the sink, I'll grab a couple of towels and I'll wipe it up. I'm just that way. You know, it's just the way our whole company is, I believe. So,
yeah. And it's, you know, I feel like I don't even have to ask the question, but it seems like a very much like a lead by example. Like, I'm doing this. This is the standard that I'm setting. This is what I do on a day to day basis. That's the expectation. Not, I'll do whatever I want, and you guys go do that stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No, that is totally true. I would not expect anyone to do the job if I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't tell one of our pilots to fly into weather that I wouldn't fly into. I wouldn't tell our pilots to come back with less fuel than I would come back with, in being a careful and prudent pilot. So, no, we do what I say and what I do.
Yeah. Well, and that, and having lived that real experience, it's actually gaining empathy in a meaningful way, not this like boilerplate way that you see everywhere. Cause I feel like, and don't take offense to this, but I feel like as a boss, people probably wouldn't say that you love everybody and I love everything and I'm so happy, but, you see a lot of that verbiage out there in the workforce, and they're like, we love everybody, we think everybody should have equal opportunities, and also, by the way, we just cut 1,800 jobs, I'm so sorry, I'm shutting off all communications. And you know, it's like fake empathy, and it's just, I appreciate the mindset of where you're coming from. on that front. So, yeah.
No, it's you're right. I mean, a company like this is a like a big family. You have your problems, you have your moments. You may not get along with someone every day, but we care for each other. We have everybody, you know, I have everybody's best interest at heart. We do the best we can to deal with the problems that come up. And in the long run, you know, if you're successful as an employee, then I'm successful as a business owner. And, you know, we look at it that way. It's, there's always going to be problems. And again, more people problems. Everybody has, you know, their deal. And, you know, the more people you have, the more of those deals you have. So, that becomes a bit, you know, it's challenging. But again, big family, the goal is the same. And, you know, I want to treat the people that work here the way I would expect to be treated. It's I'm not the guy that's, you know, come to work and you're going to work from 8 to 5 and no breaks and no water and you get 1 minute to go to the bathroom. No, none of that stuff. We just, you know, we have realistic expectations along those lines.
Yep. Okay. Well, before we wrap up, is there anything else that you want to touch on?
Well, no, I'm very happy to see that our new hangar is going to be open around the first of the year.
Nice.
And we look forward to expanding our maintenance into the Challenger line. We're looking at the 300 and 600 series Challengers as sort of our next airframe of expertise. We already have, I mean, we've operated Challengers for years, so we know the airplane pretty well. But we're now going to push really hard for that kind of work. And I guess the next holy grail for us is to have a state-of-the-art paint facility. And it's like you get one job done and we borrow money and we get this hangar built and now we're like, well, what's next? You know, we're ready to try to figure out how to make the next move. So
that's awesome.
That keeps it exciting. You always got something to look forward to.
Absolutely. And Bill, so I know that you won't be at NBAA, but FlightStar will. You'll be at West Hall booth 3041. EBIS Software will be at West Hall booth 2621. We're actually in the Tron Air booth. But yeah, before we call it, anything else that you want to touch on?
Nope. I appreciate the chance to talk and I enjoyed it.
Awesome. Thanks, Bill. I appreciate it.
Thank you.